From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll explore what people in the U.S. can learn from other nations to meet the current political moment. Then, we'll speak with the Mineral Point business owners behind the book Wisconsin Way, Cheesemaking in the Driftless.
Our collective goal is to highlight the Driftless producers, food makers, because sometimes I think in the Midwest, the food scene gets overlooked here.
Plus, we'll have the latest Live at Lake Effect episode featuring the Celtic ensemble, Solus.
This 30th anniversary celebration is proof that the music was what was the strongest, right? The music unites us still, and that's a really beautiful thing.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. There is an unprecedented shift happening in U.S. politics that's affecting not just American citizens, but our global community. The attempted destruction of USAID, a government-run organization tasked with handling humanitarian aid, has exacerbated global crises and threatens to upend the standing of the United States and its relationships with other nations. Domestically, the persecution of immigrants, both lawful and unlawful, have left many fearing for their safety. But the United States isn't the first nation to experience these threats. And there's a lot we can learn from studying how other nations have dealt with similar conflicts. Karine Kaneza-Nantulia is the Africa Deputy Director and Strategic Planning Advisor for Human Rights Watch. She joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to discuss what's happening and how people can band together to affect change.
As someone who is familiar with the political landscape of a variety of African nations, how do you view the current political climate in the U.S.? Is this surprising? Are there parallels that you see between what's happening in the United States and things you've seen elsewhere?
Definitely parallels. Thanks for the question. Definitely parallels in the sense that we see a backslide in terms of human rights protection, the promotion of the rights of not just citizens, but human rights groups, the protection of civic space, the checks and balances, which we see being eroded. At the same time, this is something we've, in my organization, we've said several times since January, is that what we see in the U.S. right now has been seen in other parts of the world, including Africa, for many years before, which is linked to this idea of the autocrat's playbook. We've seen it elsewhere, and that gives us and should give us assurances that we will be able, as a human rights organization, but also people who may be worried, who may be concerned about developments they see, the trends that they see within the U.S., whether they're related to reproductive rights, immigrants' rights, the possible weaponization of institutional mechanisms like the justice system and others. We've seen it elsewhere, and we've developed tools. People have developed tools to counteract and to respond to these threats.
When you're talking to people right now in the United States, many of whom I'm sure are going, this feels so odd, this feels so otherworldly. What is some of the advice that you have with your depth of knowledge of, you know, when people are in this panic, how do you advise them to step
them
out of that and, I don't know, try to see things from maybe a different perspective?
There are three things which are important to keep in mind. The first one is to be cognizant of the fact that people are resilient. The resilience within everyone, but especially in spaces which have groups and spaces where we've seen initiatives and the struggle for human rights take place. I mean, social movements. There's a growing dynamic within African American and people of color's movements around the concept of reparation and reparative justice. We've seen it in the last 5 years where these groups have really coalesced around the need to address reparation for the legacy of slavery, but also the harmful impact of unfair practices within the criminal justice and the harmful effects on people of color and the black community. So we've seen these attempts and they will continue. They will continue because people are resilient. What I usually say is that people need to take heart in the recognition that people are resilient. The other thing is really to be creative, right? I think what some of us see outside of the US is that there is a growing number of tools that are being used in multilateral arenas. And I'll give you an example. One example is that there is a convention for crimes against humanity that is being debated to actually add to the international legal tools that are already available. In addition to all the convention, people are thinking of how can we have a convention that's going to be addressing the gross violations of crimes against humanity. There's a concept of gender apartheid because of what has happened in Afghanistan, and Afghan women have been at the forefront of these initiatives. These are just two examples that can actually be replicated within the U.S. domestic context. How? One has to think of what kind of strategic litigation that can take place. How are we interfacing with the courts, the tribunals in the U.S.? How are we building partnerships, not just with like-minded allies, right, but with the arts community, the artist community, the private sector, keeping in mind that we have an administration whose leader, if you think of the president and if you think of the group of allies around President Trump, most of them are very sensitive to what's happening within the private sector. To what extent organizations, not just like Human Rights Watch, but other organizations can actually build bridges with a community within the private sector to actually push back and influence, not just push back, but also influence the modus operandi of the government and governmental institutions.
This is kind of taking a step back, but before President Trump took office, what were some of the, I guess, fears of having someone at the top of the United States, a country that has its hands in a lot of different nations? What was the fear of what might happen under a president like Trump?
I think in the last, I wouldn't even say one or two, I would say in the last 5 to 10 years, one of the threats that an organization like Human Rights Watch and other like-minded organizations have been faced with is this erosion of the multilateral system, the international rule-based order. So that's the first issue where, you know, you see, for instance, countries we work on, or let me just call them the crisis and conflict situations we've worked on, right? In the Middle East, you have the situation in Gaza, you have Sudan, you have Ukraine, you have the Sahel, which is a region people don't talk about often. You have what we call forgotten crises, which are crises that have never really been addressed, that are just simmering under the surface. These crisis situations, traditionally in the last maybe 20 years ago, 15 years ago, we were able, through our research, factual research, and our advocacy, to push institutions like the UN Security Council, the UN Human Rights Council, to actually address them, have them on the agenda, come up with tangible solutions, recommendations, tools to actually curb the behavior of the perpetrators. And in the last 5 to 10 years, it has become increasingly difficult. Take the example of Sudan, where we've been calling for a civilian protection force to come and be a buffer on the ground to protect civilians. We've documented unlawful killings, rampant sexual violence, destruction of civilian infrastructure, obstruction of humanitarian aid ever since the war broke out in 2023. I can name other countries where we have the same concerns. And yet, the international community, I mean African leaders, policymakers within the UN space, have not been able to agree to vote and deploy a civilian protection force. So these are some of the concerns we have. Complete erosion, complete inability, immobilization of the multilateral system. The other threat which feeds into the first one is the concept of double standards, where you see, and when we talk to our African partners, for instance, they're very vocal on that. They will say, look at what happened in Ukraine. When Russia invaded Ukraine, within a few days, you had the UN General Assembly, you had decision by the UN Security Council. It took a few months maybe a year, to have the International Criminal Court open an investigation. Look at Sudan. Look at Ethiopia, where we documented ethnic cleansing against the Tigrayans in the northern part of the country during a war that opposed the federal government and Tigrayan forces, armed forces. With the rise of right-wing parties in the West, because I think talking about Trump will be insufficient. It's not just about him being a president now, it's also the context under which he becomes president. These threats become exacerbated. You see immigration being weaponized, security concerns heightened, borders, especially within Europe, really becoming a battleground in terms of their domestic and foreign policies. These are the threats we see that a presidency that is not open, that is not strategically inclined to address those threats, will be highly problematic.
It's interesting, the moment that we're living in. There's this idea of democracy as something that just kind of exists, and then democracy as really a verb, as the things that we do in order to ensure that people have democracy. And we've kind of lost sight of one as we've propped up the other. What do you think people on the ground here in the United States really need to understand about this moment in our history that maybe we're not quite grasping at the moment?
I almost want to say, and this is something I've said to some of my American friends and colleagues, I think there's certain things which have been taken for granted, which should never be taken for granted again. I think that's, for me, the most important lesson. On my way here, we're having this discussion when we're talking about the freedom of association and freedom of expression. Just that, right? We're talking about how pro-Palestine students, like this young man from New York's Columbia University, was arrested and is, you know, not sure if he's still in custody. And lives get disrupted through one executive order. And I think what we see right now is that the words on a piece of paper in a very short period of time can be translated into harmful actions that can disrupt and destroy lives. That is the moment we live in. And what it means people have to be vigilant. That's what it means. Never take your rights for granted. It means people really have to be creative. They really have to be creative in terms of what is the toolbox? What can we stop using because it's not working anymore? What do we need to expand on? What are the new tools that we can maybe borrow from elsewhere? Latin America, Africa, Europe, Asia, Middle East, parts of the world where the fight for democracy and rule of law has taken place for decades now. I think it's a moment of solidarity as well. It's an important moment for Americans to look outside, not just outside of the box, but outside of the U.S. The playbook of every autocrat is there. We know it. We need to have our own playbook. We need to devise our own playbook as human rights activists, practitioners, those who thrive at ensuring that there is justice, accountability, a viable, enabling, rule-based environment for everyone.
Yeah. We will see what the future holds.
Thank you.
Karine, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Karine Kaneza-Nantulia is the Africa Deputy Director and Strategic Planning Advisor with Human Rights Watch. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. At WUWM.com, you can hear an extended version of their conversation. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen to us on demand. Coming up in about 15 minutes, our latest Live at Lake Effect with the Celtic group Solas explores how playing Irish music together has changed over the last 30 years.
It, for me, is a beautiful way of seeing how traditions move people and give them a sense of belonging and identity and how you'll push and pull on that tradition with your own creativity as a musician.
But first, we'll hear from three business owners who collaborated on a book that highlights Wisconsin cheesemakers. That's coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Mineral Point is a small town in Wisconsin's Driftless region, but despite its size, it has a rich history. In the 1800s, Cornish immigrants came to the area for a lead mining boom. That boom has long since ended, but many of the town's historic buildings, from miners' cottages to businesses, remain. Family history stretched back generations in Mineral Point. But people are drawn to live and work there, too. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz met three of those people, a bookstore owner, a pastry chef, and a publisher. The three of them collaborated on a book called Wisconsin Way, Cheesemaking in the Driftless. They share how they came together to highlight 12 cheesemakers and shine a light on Wisconsin's food scene. We'll first hear how they each ended up in Mineral Point, starting with Kristen Mitchell, owner of Little Creek Press.
I grew up outside Madison. And my husband, his family's third generation Mineral Point. So when we decided to get married, we moved back here so he could work for the family's third generation hardware store business. So yeah, so we've been here since 1994.
We've been here since 2007. We were living in Madison and came to Mineral Point on a weekend and just fell in love with the town, decided to move out here.
So what about it was so compelling?
The architecture, the amount of creativity, just that it felt like a very peaceful, supportive, creative space.
I moved here 6 years ago, and I knew nothing about Mineral Point. We discovered our house on Zillow, and we fell in love with it the second we saw it, and we moved here 3 hours later.
You did it?
Yes, we purchased it. We looked at it for about 10 minutes, and we put in an offer, and 3 hours later, we were owners of Spensley Farm. And so I discovered the town of Mineral Point shortly after that, and that was just a bonus, kind of like the ribbon was tied with this wonderful town. So
what's so wonderful about it? We talked about architecture, but...
Sure, but certainly the community is really amazing and supportive. And when you have an idea, it just seems to happen here magically.
With a lot of work along going with it.
Of course, a lot of work. But, you know, it's just really inspiring to be around people who get things done and have these great ideas.
So talk about your publishing operation and how that came to life.
I had a graphic design business that I started when our first son was born, so 27 and a half years ago. And then 14 years ago, Al Felly, Felly's Flowers in Madison, he and his wife, his partner, had a cottage here. And he came to me and asked me if I would take this story that he'd written about the Santas he'd carved in his retirement and if I would create a book out of it. I'd already done book design, but I hadn't done anything beyond that. So I started the publishing company to support him and then ideally eventually support other authors. So that was 14 years ago in January, and we've got a couple hundred books out now. We'll publish about 30 books this year. Yeah, so it's grown tremendously since its inception. And I really never set out to be a publisher. That was never my goal. I was like, oh, I'm gonna be a publisher. This just happened kind of organically, and now I'm riding the wave.
Keith, did this bookstore start organically?
Yeah, pretty much. I've just always been a reader. I love books. Bookstores have been one of my favorite places. Whenever I travel, that's what I look for, is the local bookstores. And Mineral Point didn't have a bookstore. We'd had a used bookstore when I moved to town, and there'd been some other bookstores in the past, but it'd been a long time since we'd had a real bookstore. And I was also, you know, feeling like I needed a change in my life. This is around COVID. And I live across the street from the bookstore and knew the owner of this building, and turned out she was selling it, and I decided, well, now that would make a great bookstore, and I'd have a short commute. So I just went for it.
Just jump across the street.
Yep. The bookstore started off as it was supposed to be a low-stress, you know, quote-unquote retirement job. And that, my idea was it would be a part-time bookstore. Well, that's not really how it worked out, and which is great. It's been better and more full of life than I even hoped it would be. But it's also clear that it's a thing that it can't just be me running. And so recently brought in more people to work at the bookstore, including Nicole, who's going to work at the bookstore one day a week to help me out. So more of a team effort going forward.
So, Nicole, you began by selling your pastries at the farmer's market.
I'm a pastry chef, trained pastry chef. I didn't know anyone when I moved to Mineral Point, and I thought I'd start at the farmer's market, and I started selling baked goods there. The goal there was just to meet people in the community, and hopefully pastries would fit in somewhere. And so I did that for 2 years, and then Keith opened the bookstore, and I just weaseled my way in.
Well, it's an interesting story how that happens. So in Mineral Point, we have a thing called the New Business Task Force, which is a semi-official group organized by the chamber that is just mostly business owners and or other like city officials or whatever who try to help people who want to open a new business in town or expand a business or just need to find a lawyer or find a plumber or whatever help we can do to help businesses. And Kristen, myself, and Nicole were all at a meeting where we were all part of that group. And my version of the story, Nicole's is different, is that after the meeting, Nicole asked to come see the space, which we'd bought the building at that point. It was sort of a gutted space, just open. And she said, you don't want this whole building for books. You should let me put a kitchen in the back. And I agreed. So the bookstore opened almost 2 years ago, and the kitchen was 6-8 months after that.
And the real story?
Well, I met Keith and Leslie at the farmer's market, and I ran into Leslie just walking down the street, and she told me that they were opening a bookstore, and I offered to help select some cookbooks that I love, and I thought that that would be a great addition to the cookbook section. Then, when I saw the space and how large it was, I suggested that Keith open a teaching kitchen, and he said, you know, I'm not really interested in that. I just want to sell books. And so in my 5-minute drive home, my mind was twirling with all these ideas for the kitchen, and I went home and did a PowerPoint presentation, and I called it Keith's Bookstore Kitchen. And I emailed it to him, and he ignored me. And when I ran into him a few days later, I asked, did you see the presentation? He said, oh, yes, I did, but I still don't want to open up a teaching kitchen. You're a chef. You should do it. And I said it was just too much work. And then we started, well, let's just see how much it will cost to build out the kitchen. And the next thing I know, I have a contract with a plumber and an electrician, and here we are. It took about nine months to build out the kitchen, and then we opened in January of 2024.
So let's dive into the Wisconsin way. Who came up with the initial aha?
Joe Burns, who's a local cheesemaker, one of the owners of Brunco Cheese, did a class here at the Book Kitchen. It went really well, and I think after the class, Joe said we could curate, bring in other cheesemakers and do other classes. And we just kind of thought, well, that actually sounds like that would make a really good book. Like each chapter could be a different cheesemaker. We all already knew Kristen and had wanted to work on more projects with Kristen. And so we had a meeting and discussed this. And the book kind of evolved originally from, I think originally maybe it was a cookbook. And then it evolved to more like a guidebook, but a pretty straightforward, like, these are the cheesemakers in the Driftless area. This is the cheeses they make. As the work began, the book kind of grew and became more about the people behind the companies and the individual stories that led them to where they were. And it just turned into something we're all really proud of.
Yes. Mm-hmm. amazingly, we got to all 12 cheesemakers in the most gorgeous week of September, last September. When we started talking to them and, you know, seeing their property and especially the farmsteads, we just realized that there was more depth to this than just a guidebook. Their backgrounds, and some of them were, you know, came from generations of cheesemakers, and some of them didn't. And their stories were equally interesting and fascinating. But the common thread that I found most interesting was their connection to the land and their respect for it and their use of it. And how the topography of the Driftless really shapes the taste of their cheese. Initially, when we thought about the project, we didn't think about all of those aspects: people, connection to land, respect for land. We didn't think about any of those things. And then that was very first and foremost that we need to dive a little bit deeper into this.
The other thing I would add is this: the collaborative nature between all of the cheesemakers. They don't see themselves as competition. They see themselves as teammates, as collaborators, which I think mimics what we're doing. You know, three completely different businesses collaborating on one project that will benefit so many people, including the whole region we live in. I think that was the other theme that came through as a collaborative.
I think our collective goal is to really highlight the Driftless producers, food makers, because sometimes I think in the Midwest, especially in food, the food scene gets overlooked here. And we have an incredible food scene that just is on par with, you know, Napa Valley and Hudson Valley and all of these other places. But I don't know the reason, but for some reason, it just doesn't get the recognition that it deserves. And so our goal was to, you know, take the cream of the crop, basically, of the Driftless and highlight them. And the idea is to filter that down into the other food producers that are so unique here and food makers that are so unique here, to really highlight our entire area and not just cheese.
Something like 20 million people live within a two-hour drive of the Driftless. And most of those 20 million people have no idea what the Driftless is, haven't heard that phrase. And, you know, looking at a map would just assume that this is the same as every other part of the Midwest. It's a very Midwestern place, but there's some differences to the culture and the lifestyle in the Driftless that are really driven by the geology and the geography. And the, you know, the land is such that it works really well for small farms, and it's really hard to do a lot of large farming here. So unlike, you know, the big cornfields of Illinois or, you know, wheat fields of Kansas or other places, we tend to have a lot more small producers. It also works really well for dairy, so we have a lot of great dairy farmers and a lot of great cheesemakers. And so because of all these things combining, we have incredible organic farmers, we have incredible dairy, we have incredible cheese, incredible beer makers, an up-and-coming wine industry. This is such a great food area, and it's kind of the food basket for the Midwest. And people don't really know. A great example is the U.S. Cheese Championship just happened this week. And just to pick one category, for the soft sheep's milk cheeses, five of the top six are in our book for the whole country. And that was true in lots of the other categories that you see, the cheesemakers we talked about and other cheesemakers of the Driftless, just all over the awards of the U.S. Cheese Championship. This is the highest concentration of great cheesemakers in the country. And it's, you know, I think people sometimes think Wisconsin cheese is just, you know, cheese curds and bulk cheese, and really it's an industry on par with the cheesemakers in Europe and anywhere else.
How has this energized your devotion to what you're doing?
The opportunity to reach such a large audience and educate them on what is happening here. I mean, we have this beautiful vehicle now that people can pick up and look at and hold in their hands and share.
I have a bookstore, people can come, I can talk to them about Mineral Point, about the Driftless area, but I'm doing that one by one as people come through the bookstore. This is a different kind of opportunity, that this can be in every bookstore in Wisconsin. This can be sold at every, you know, nice cheese shop in the country. This is something that anyone who's eating cheese is going to be interested in and can be available to them. So it has a reach that we don't otherwise have when we're focusing on individual people in our spaces.
Well, I think I have a completely different appreciation than I did, you know, 6 months ago, 8 months ago. Sure, I've had most of the cheeses that we featured in the book before, but somehow they taste a little bit different knowing how they were made and who made them and their process. Kind of everything came full circle just being on the farm, seeing that process and then eating that. It was just this like culmination of this, you know, this raw product taken to this delicious finished stage that I can talk about and share and cook with or serve an apple with, and it's going to be so delicious. And so for me, that was just it was a true educational experience and just so fun to be on.
That was Nicole Bujeski, the founder of The Book Kitchen, Keith Burrows, the co-owner of Republic of Letters Books, and Kristen Mitchell, the owner of Little Creek Press. They all spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz, about the book they collaborated on called Wisconsin Way, Cheesemaking in the Driftless. We're currently in a brand new season of Bubbler Talk, and we need some new questions from you. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break and then return with the latest episode in our Live at Lake Effect series. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Live at Lake Effect is our music series featuring artists performing in the Lake Effect Surf Shop in Shorewood. We brought the Lake Effects together, along with Visionary Studios, to showcase local and nationally touring musicians. Today, we have the Celtic ensemble Solas, who are celebrating their 30th anniversary together. Their name comes from an Irish word meaning light, and are known not only for playing traditional Irish music, but Solas also performs original works influenced by country, rock, and Americana genres in over a dozen albums so far. Here's vocalist Maura Smiley introducing one of the songs Solas played in the surf shop.
This is called The Newry Highwayman, and it was recorded on the first Solas album, self-titled.
Town I was bred and born, in Stephen's Green I lie in scorn. I served me time at the saddler's trade. I always was a roving blade. I always was a roving blade. At 17 I took a wife. I loved her dearer than I loved me life. And so to keep her to come and guard in a
Hi, this is Audrey Nowakowski from Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. We're here at the Lake Effect Surf Shop in Shorewood, along with Milwaukee musician Trapper Shep, who's also a fellow Live at Lake Effect co-producer. Hello, Trapper.
Hello, Audrey, as a fan of Irish music. I am quite delighted to be welcoming one of America's finest Celtic groups to our makeshift studio here today. And can we start off with little bit of an introduction for each of you?
My name's John Williams. I'm from the south side of Chicago. Kept moving north over time, and I'm up here in Wisconsin today. Beautiful Shorewood neighborhood playing the button accordion.
And my name is Winifred Horan, and I'm playing the fiddle. And I was born and raised on the beach, Rockaway, New York, so I feel very at home here in the surf shop. Yes.
My name is Seamus Egan. I was born in Philadelphia, grew up in Ireland, and then I live in Vermont now. And I have never been on a surfboard and probably never will be. So this is about as close as I'll be to surfing. I'm excited.
Yeah.
My name is Maura Smiley. I'm singing, and I grew up in Vermont and lived in California, Southern California, for a long time. But, I never got onto a surfboard either. So great to be here.
My name is Alan Murray, and I grew up in Scotland. I have been on a surfboard exactly one time and nearly died. So I'm getting only the slightest hint of PTSD coming in here.
It's not that hard, you guys.
No.
It really isn't. It just takes a little bit of core strength, which...
It broke my nose and nearly knocked me out and under the water. So.
Oh, yeah. Okay. It can be frightening, but anyway, maybe we'll do a band trip.
Here we go.
Maybe you guys will take us.
There you go. Next
is there
treat.
Good surfing here?
Come back to Milwaukee.
Right, just right next door. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, well, thank you all for being here today and for sharing some music. And throughout our station's history here at WWM, we've had the opportunity to record a ton of great Irish, Scottish, Celtic bands from across the pond and also Canada, of course, through Irish Fest, which happens every summer here in Milwaukee. So for those of you members here today who might have played it, do you have any memories or takeaways of this event? Like, are we a standout? Like, and I'm just asking as a local, like, how do we stand out to Irish bands?
I mean, it's an amazing achievement. It's been going for so long, and it's just grown to be, I mean, I think it's one of the largest Irish festivals anywhere. It's quite the achievement. So, yeah, I mean, it's always an event, you know, when you know it's coming up, you see it on the calendar, and, you know, it's just the energy of the crowd is great. And for us on the musician side, it's great to just run into your friends that you don't really see all that often because everyone's, you know, scattered all over the globe. So it's a nice way to catch up with folks over a few days.
Yeah. How many times have you guys played Summerfest or Irish Fest?
Too
rather?
Many times. Actually.
A lot. Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah. Did it a lot. Like our first year, I think, when we were together as a band, it was our first big ask, you know? And then we did it a few times over the years. I don't know, 6-7 times. Mm-hmm. And then others, we've all played with other ensembles. So really, it's a lot that our faces have been at that festival, over the years.
It's a remarkable event. I got to see Tommy Makem's son play with, I think, Liam Clancy's son, and just getting to see the generations of Irish music. It's so similar to me because I come from a folk music tradition, and so much Irish music informed early 60s, folk music in America. And I was curious, what drew some of you into Irish music who may not have been born in Ireland? Because for me, it's that uplifting quality that can really kind of break your heart and make you laugh at the same time.
Well, I mean, I think we probably all had our unique entrances to Irish music. I mean, but I think if there's a shared way in, I mean, we kind of grew up in sort of in the Irish community, we weren't far from it at any point. I mean, we probably all started the actual learning of an instrument in different ways, but we grew up in it, you know, and there was a way of, in my case, my parents just wanted their children to have some connection to where they came from. Certainly there was no plan to it or anything. It was just like, here's the tin whistle, go learn a couple of tunes. And, you know, so I think we all have a version of that story.
I think it's important to highlight the fact that, as Seamus said, you know, we grew up in that community, in the Irish community, but growing up here in the United States, you know, all of these communities were multicultural. Like, it wasn't just, you know, I grew up in a very Irish Catholic community in New York, but I was also neighbors with the Italians, the Polish people, the, you know, you name it. And so growing up in an immigrant community, wherever your people are from, it's a common thread. Like, immigrants have this severe, passionate longing for home, the home they've left. So it seems to me anyway, and I think the guys would agree, that growing up in those homes where our parents were actually missing home, making a new life here in the United States, wanting to have their children exposed to their culture, that goes for any immigrant community. And it's a beautiful thing, actually. So that definitely was how I was raised, you know, to embrace my Irish heritage, but also embrace the other cultures and heritage around me.
Well, your group has been around for 30 years now. And Seamus, you were with it from the beginning. And I know you've had members come and go. So can you all remind me, like, what iteration you're on, or like how many years you've been with the band?
Well, Wynn and myself.
I've been here for 40 years.
Yeah. Wynn and John and myself were in the very first iteration of the band when we started in, you know, in the mid 90s. And that was, Wynn and myself were in New York and John was in Chicago. But I've lost track of how many iterations there have been over the years, but this is the, you know, obviously the latest.
This is the 30th anniversary. Yeah.
So Maura has been was in the band as well for a while and did some recording with us. But this is Alan's first spin around with the band, so we're happy to have him. He doesn't know what he's gotten into yet.
He'll find out.
Well, and I'm curious, out of all the decades you've been playing together, how you think Irish music has shifted in America over the course of these years, as you've been actively like participating in that scene.
Ooh, I don't know.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
I have one perspective on it, is that it, for me, is a beautiful way of seeing how traditions move people and give them a sense of belonging and identity, and how you'll push and pull on that tradition with your own creativity as a musician. And there'll be like eras where you want to pull kind of really far away from the original, I mean, so-called original way of doing it. And like as a performer, you kind of arrange and perform and like pull it in a really far direction. And then the next generation will pull it back closer to kind of the community music that it was. And then the next generation will take it further afield and like get influenced by all sorts of things. And I've so enjoyed watching how Irish music kind of stands the test of those eras and keeps coming back for new listeners and players.
Well, it's even on TikTok during the pandemic. Yeah. Sea shanties were really starting to go viral, all of these jigs. And it was during that time that I open-tuned my guitar, sat down and watched Paul Brady sing Arthur McBride and wanted to figure out all those shapes. So it's really kind of life-changing, and you have to spend the time with the music, and there needs to be some entry point. And I'm just curious, as a younger person that really loves traditional Irish music, how you toe the line of operating in that tradition in the year 2025, like how you try to keep pushing it forward but staying true to the roots.
Well, I guess when something becomes or is placed onto the world stage, like Irish music and Irish culture in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s here, like you were talking about yesterday, the advent of the internet, but Riverdance, Lord of the Dance, the Chieftains, you mentioned Tommy Makem and the Clancy Brothers. We've had a lot of help, you know, from our peers and our colleagues to continue to bring the music that was originally performed in shebeens and kitchens around Ireland. So to actually get it onto the world stage over the last 40, 50 years has been a joint effort, right? And to your question, how we keep it moving forward and real for us, I think for Solace, I think it's a true awareness of when something becomes, well, monetized or has to have a certain polish to appear on the stage, I think we've actually rebelled to a certain degree at some of those notions, but also with respect, we're not afraid to push the envelope a little bit while remaining respectful to what people like Tommy Makem, the Clancy Brothers, Patty Maloney of the Chieftains made possible for us to do. And at the same time, encouraging the younger generation, whether it be through our live shows, all of us are teachers, workshops around the country, you know, in actively encouraging the younger generation to take a risk and pick up the guitar, keep playing the banjo, you know, don't give up because it doesn't seem like it's, you know, cool.
Well, you're a beautiful link in a very long chain.
Well, speaking of being a beautiful link in a long chain, few groups can say they have 30 years, you know, together. So what are some of the joys or the things you keep central to yourselves that have kept you playing music together all these years?
Well, the thing that I like to remember, and some of what came up here today, is Irish music on the stage. But in the big picture, most Irish music happens outside the stage and away from recording studios and lights. And with the internet now, it's, you know, there's more eyes on screens. But, I mean, we all learned from waitresses, janitors, steel workers, butchers. So for me, it's the voice and the music of the common people that we bring onto stage.
Staying together as a band for 30 years has not been piece of cake, right? So being in a band, you should be bringing 100% of your talent every single time that you appear together, you know, but I'll say that touring and traveling the world at the extent that Sullis did over the course of the life of the band was extremely taxing and life-altering. But I think this is proof, I'm pretty sure it is. This is proof, this 30th anniversary celebration is proof that the music was what was the strongest, right? The music unites us still, and that's a really beautiful thing. And but
we would be playing.
And we worked hard.
Anyway.
We worked hard, and we would be playing anyway.
So it's like, you know, sort of, it's nice that we've had this sort of vehicle that allowed us to travel around the world and experience all these things. But if that hadn't even happened, we'd still be playing at home at the very least, you know what I mean? So it's just part of life, really.
And here we are.
So we got lucky that we have an opportunity to, you know, to do it.
To harness it.
The songs and spirit of Sullis is very strong, and we are so grateful that you've come into our little surf shop.
This is great.
In Shorewood. Strange enough. World's meeting.
Well,
thank you so much.
In 30 years, it's the first time we've played in a surf shop. So
yeah,
there
we go.
Always something new to experience. So maybe next time we'll be on the surfboard.
There we go.
That'd be great.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yay.
Thanks.
That was the Celtic group Sullis, featuring multi-instrumentalist Seamus Egan, Winifred Horan on the fiddle, Morris Smiley on vocals, John Williams on the button accordion, and Alan Murray on backup vocals and guitar. Be sure to head to WUWM.com and our YouTube page to watch them performing three original songs in the Lake Effect Surf Shop. Milwaukee musician Trapper Shep and myself are the executive producers of Live at Lake Effect. Sound engineering is done by WUWM's Jason Reavy. And thanks to our friends at Visionary Studios, a local advertising agency, for filming and editing this episode. WUWM's YouTube page also has our past episodes of Live at Lake Effect, featuring Blitz and Trapper, Buffalo Nichols, The Wild Feathers, and many more. That wraps up the show for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll hear from both candidates running for state superintendent. Plus, we'll look at the list of Milwaukee's best restaurants. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.